The Anatomy Education Podcast is supported by the American Association of Anatomists. The American Association of Anatomists is a scientific membership organization with the mission of advancing anatomical science through research, education, and professional development. For information on its range of membership options, scientific meetings, and grants funding portfolio, please visit www.anatomy.org. Welcome to the Anatomy Education Podcast. So hello again everyone, and today it is a real pleasure to welcome Leonard Shapiro to the podcast. Leonard is an observation teacher in human anatomy at the Department of Human Biology at the University of Cape Town in South Africa. Leonard, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
Thanks, James. Thanks for having me. Great to be on.
No worries. And obviously I'm sitting here in Leeds, which it's not too bad for Leeds. It's quite a We've got some blue sky, which makes a very pleasant change. It's not raining, and we've just had a few days of some quite heavy rain. But as I see you in the kind of window on my screen as we do this through Skype, it looks glorious. You've got the sun radiating onto your back there. How is it in South Africa today?
Well, it is glorious, and although we do have a blue sky, we are praying for rain because there's a drought here. I don't know if you're aware. We are in the midst of a serious drought, so we're looking forward to rain, and we hope to have a lot of rain in winter.
Yeah, okay, so hopefully the rain gods will bring some clouds over and obviously remedy that drought that you're going through. How long's the drought been going on for?
It's been about a year, but it's been in the making for about 2 years. It's just been 2 years of very dry summers.
Yeah.
And so we need to be quite sparing with the water.
Okay. Well, as you know, as an Englishman, then I like to talk about the weather, but maybe we should move on to something else and not spend the whole podcast talking.
Look, it's still really nice. The weather is still beautiful, as you said.
Good. Yeah. Good. Okay. Well, like I say, thank you for coming on the podcast, and I suppose this is the first of two podcasts that are going to occur over the next fortnight that really focus on art and anatomy. And I think we can really explore some of your kind of background into anatomy through the prism of this kind of art background that you have. And then we can talk about some of the more experiences you have and some of the workshops you run regarding this. But I suppose the first place to start would be, you know, where did this interest in art come from, and then specifically human anatomy? How did those two things come together?
Well, I grew up in a family of artists. My mother is an artist, and so I was exposed to art from a very young age. I went to art school at the University of Cape Town and got a degree in fine art, and then I'm very keen on drawing, so I drew a lot of portraits of myself and other people, and then also went to life drawing, which involves drawing nude models. And when I draw my own portrait, I have in front of me a mirror and a soft tissue x-ray of my head, as well as a human skull. And so when I draw my head, I palpate the bones in my skull, and so that I don't just draw the superficial soft tissue. I'm drawing a drawing of the entire head, because when people draw, I mean, if you Google portrait drawings, you'll get these very, very hyper-realistic drawings, which, although they look really impressive, they are actually incredibly superficial. In other words, they really just deal with the surface. But what what real artists will do, for example, one of my favorite artists being Frank Auerbach and Giacometti, they will draw the head, including what is beneath the skin. So to go back to your question about how I got interested in anatomy, that is one of the steps. Of course, artists like Michelangelo and Kitai, more contemporary artists, they study the cadavers in order to render the body more more believable when they drew the body.
Sorry, Len, to touch you there, but this interest in the human form, what was it about that got you interested in drawing kind of humans as opposed to drawing buildings or fruit or other things that I had to draw when I was doing my kind of art lessons at school? What is it about the human form that interested you so much?
Well, the human form, it's not so easy to draw. It's very organic. It's always moving. Traditionally in art, the human form has always been a subject. I guess when I was really young, I got this model of the human, a model of an anatomical person, where you could see all the organs inside. I mean, I don't think that had to do with it. I've just always been fascinated with that. And at art school, there's something quite absorbing when you look at the human body in different positions and draw it. And it actually gives you a really deep insight of another kind, a different type of knowledge and observation of the human body, because we all know that the body is bilaterally symmetrical. Yet, when I was drawing it one day, when I was drawing a human body one day, through the drawing, and it's very difficult to describe this scientifically, but through this drawing process, the observation of the person sitting there and drawing them, I got to understand this bilateral symmetry in a way that was non-intellectual. It was more a sort of fundamental understanding without all the science, so-called, involved. It was a very fundamental, almost first sight understanding of the body. And it sort of hit me like, my goodness, you know, there's this person who's similar on both sides. So, I mean, I've just said that, but does it make any sense? It's something that it's more of an intuitive,
yes,
gut first, a first sort of sight or first hand direct experience of the human body.
So, this is new territory for me. This is an area that I'm not familiar with at all. But I suppose what you're trying to describe, perhaps, or how maybe I could interpret what you're describing, is you're trying to really interpret the form of the body beyond just what it looks like in a very kind of simple sense, but try and add in some real kind of texture to it and some feeling to it, that it's more than just a shape.
Yes, yes, that is true. And when it comes to drawing, well, I mean, I've drawn the cadaver quite a lot, the human cadaver, and I guess this touches on what we're talking about now, which is this incredible discovery of what is really there. Because drawing really helps you to see more, to observe more, to know more about what's there. And so when I draw either a human, a living human being, or as I call them, a non-living human being, you know, a cadaver, then there's often a sense of incredible discovery and wonder that happens, you know, like when I'm drawing a cadaver and I open the skin flap of the chest, and I'll put my hand in, because I explore and observe with touch as well as sight. So I'll put my hand between the skin flap and the ribs, and it's quite an intimate position to be in, to have your hand right inside someone's body.
So maybe we could talk about this first time, or this first opportunity that you had when you got to actually go and see a cadaver, and you worked with a senior lecturer, where you actually went into a cadaver lab for the first time and gave this kind of a very personal experience of going in there. And and observing that for the first time. I wonder if you could maybe explore those kind of emotions that were going on and what happened then.
Yes, I was drawing it. I was drawing the cadaver and looking, and then at first I was really struggling with the drawing. And then I realized, wait a minute, you need to get your hands involved here. You really need to get in there. And, you know, with respect, obviously. And then I did get in there. I did put my hands in. And that changed the way that I observed it, the way I saw it, the way I understood it, and the way that I drew it. Because the drawing is just a reflection. Drawing is just marks made on paper. So the drawing was a reflection. It's just a reflection of what one is observing. So I did experience, you know, an absolute wonder, a sense of wonder about the human body.
And yeah, you have, there's a long history of kind of art and anatomy. And I wonder sometimes nowadays when people draw anatomical structures, they are drawing them with a bias that they have because they've seen them already, and how yes. that actually feeds into their drawing of a subject, of a item, of a thing, whatever it is they're drawing, you know, human or not human. We can all draw a pen, can't we? Because we know what a pen looks like. But I suppose, yes. you know, back in, you know, we spoke about this, you know, just before we pressed record on the podcast, you know, back in, when was it, the 15th century or something, when Andreas Vesalius was looking at the human form for the first time. He didn't have an anatomy atlas to refer to.
Certainly.
He was looking at the human form, and then, I don't know, you tell me, did he then start dissecting himself and drawing out the individual organs? Because there's some fantastic images that people can, you know, just Google and see them.
Yes. Well, you know, when people draw, as you say, the human body or the anatomical parts nowadays, they have already looked at an anatomy atlas, and they've looked at these anatomical parts which are annotated. So in that sense, they are already looking at anatomical parts that are, you know, quote unquote, fragmented, or they're looking at a view of it that is already predetermined, which, and I'm not putting down the anatomy atlas, I'm talking about this process of observation as a completely complementing it. And so when you look, I mean, for example, Vesalius would have, without the atlas, looked at the human form just as it was and had to explore and do that pioneering of drawing it, observing it, taking notes. And indeed, his anatomical atlas, which is still referred to today, has the most incredible written descriptions. Those are his annotations. So they have a little number on, you know, anatomical part. And then there is this very, very, very lengthy and fantastic descriptions to read, which are as relevant today as yes. they were then. I mean, the body hasn't changed in 500 years.
No.
You know, arguably, you know.
I think people are a little bit more obese now than they were 500 years ago. Huh. You know, yes. they've been rewarded for the success of the human, perhaps, and maybe the form has changed slightly, but not in a good way, perhaps. But that's interesting, because you've got people like Vesalius, and you've got people like Da Vinci, and you've got more recently, I suppose, Carter, who worked with Henry Gray, and some of their artwork is just beautiful. It's the sort, I've got some of pictures of Da Vinci on my wall in my office here, because they're just, then to me, they're not anatomy pictures, they're pieces of art that just depict yes. the human body. But I suppose it is interesting, because if I was to go and dissect an area, if I was to go and look at a prosection of an area, then I look at an atlas beforehand, or I look at a textbook, look at a cartoon interpretation of that. But these people, they really were pioneers, because to think that they described really detailed areas like the perineal pouches, like the infratemporal fossa, really complex areas, and just trying to find them for the first time without any guidance is, to me, it's incredible.
Well, I think it speaks to real observation without the prejudice of what people think they should be looking at. But I can just like to say that these artworks, these pictures that you have and that we see normally, that are sort of the people see as a standard of drawing, the kind of drawing we're talking about here is absolutely not that. There were reasons why those quite realistic drawings were done, but we don't need to go into those. But the type of drawing that we do in observation, in the method that I teach, is really far from that. The drawings we do are very, very gestural, and they can look messy, as it were, in comparison to those. But the purpose of the marks that we make in order to help our observation, because drawing is just marks on paper. It's nothing more than that. A lot of people think, oh, I can't draw, et cetera, et cetera. But everybody can draw, and everybody that I've taught has been able to draw, even though they protested in the beginning they can't, because they have a definition that they need to draw the images like the artworks that you're describing about Michelangelo and Leonardo da Vinci, etc. But if we look at drawings, for example, who the British artist Frank Auerbach does, they look incredibly abstract or messy, his drawings of the head. But yet the lines that he makes they describe very, very well the actual head. Same with Giacometti, who people might know more about. His drawings are very, very gestural. And in this drawing process, in using touch and sight, we use our drawing hand simply to reflect what we are observing with our hand. It's almost like making notes about what we are observing as we palpate the an area of the human body. Yeah. I just felt I should bring that in so that you don't think that, oh, you know, we have to do these really, really super,
drawings. I appreciate that. And I think there's two things we can talk about in a moment. We can talk about actually how you go about doing this observational drawing and the mechanics of how you actually do it. We can talk about that. I'd also like to talk about the visit you made to London when you looked at, is it Frank Albert at the Tate Gallery? Talk about that. But just before we go on to that, I just wondered if you could talk about the first time you saw the cadaver and in its entirety. Because obviously I'm looking at you now and I can see your eyes, I can see your ears, I can see your teeth, I can see your hair, I can see everything about you. But actually, I remember the first time I saw a cadaver when I was an undergraduate student, and you pull back the sheet and they have hair and they have teeth, they have eyes, but it does look very different, and you are looking at the same thing. And I just wonder that contrast.
Yes. Okay. I remember now, actually. At first, it was actually quite a shock, and it was not pleasant at first. You're looking at death, really.
Yes.
You know, I mean, they try and mask it off, you know, you wear a white coat and gloves and all this type of thing. They do try and anesthetize oneself to it. But actually, you're looking at a human being without life. And so it wasn't pleasant. And that's when I realized I needed to go further in order to see what was really there, which was, you know, the wonder of the human body.
Yes.
But no, it wasn't pleasant at first, you know.
Because there are different stages, aren't there? So we walk around and we see each other, we see humans all of the time, and we're clothed. We are wearing clothes. But we go home and, you know, as we get ready to go in the shower or get ready to go in, into bed or something.
Yes.
We're naked and we look different then. But this again is one step removed from that.
Yes.
And the human form then is totally different. And I suppose that comes back to how drawing and the art and the anatomy is actually getting under the skin.
Yes.
Not in the kind of sense of seeing the organs, but just to give that person in the drawing a personality.
It's certainly, yes, one gets under the skin. One therefore is, as I was describing with the way I draw my own portrait, my own head or the head of another person, it's understanding what's underneath. It actually gives more life or more reality to the head or to the body. Because, as I said, you know, Michelangelo was someone who did study the cadaver, and Kitaj, that's spelled K-I-T-A-J, an artist also from Britain, but since went to live in California, it's no longer with us. But he also studied the cadaver, and you can see it in some of the knees that he draws and paints. You could see that he knows what's under there.
Yes.
He knows what's under the skin. And it's knowing that, and when you draw and you include in your drawing what's under the skin, you then get a more convincing drawing. Because if you just took a photograph of someone's knee, it is not showing that. It's the same with botanical artists. They will not take a photograph. They will be able to show more by doing a botanical painting or botanical drawing. In the same way, when one is drawing the human body, let's stick with the knee, and you take a photograph, you see what the camera sees. You only see what the camera sees, which is on the surface. But when you understand what's under there, when you've looked under the skin, and then you render this, what you draw it, you make marks that indicate what you've observed under there, you get a really, really convincing image of the knee.
Yes.
And for that reason, I think anatomical illustration, even though the drawing I'm talking about of the knee is quite different in terms of studying it, but the illustrations that are in the anatomy atlas, they are essentialized drawings, essentialized drawings of an anatomical part. Yet I'm sure that the people who study, the anatomical illustrators will go through a lot of drawing exploration to understand what's really there before they come to these essentialized, or what they call contour drawings of.
Yes.
I don't want to get too complicated about it. But,
No. We're happy to avoid the complicated part. That's interesting, isn't it? Because there's two things. There are the diagrams, or the images, the pictures that Carter drew that we can still find in Gray's Anatomy today. And they are very much what you're talking about then, aren't they? They are fact-based, aren't they? This nerve runs in relationship to this artery in this position, you know, and this muscle is this long, attaches this specific point on the bony structure. And I suppose Vesalius did things like that as well. It wasn't that it wasn't anatomically correct, but a lot of his drawings, the cadaver that he was drawing was in a posture.
Yes.
Was actually in a kind of an active pose. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, this has just come off the top of my head, so I put you on the spot, Leonard. But I don't know if there was a reason for them presenting those drawings in that way. Because maybe the time that these drawings were being presented, and whether there are any taboos about the human body and creation and evolution and all of that and where we come from, whether that was a role in how they presented those drawings? Yes. Sorry to put you on the spot. I don't know if...
No, that's fine. Look, I'm not an expert on Versalius, but I do know that, yes, as you say, there was a taboo around that. They often had to take bodies from graves and executed criminals. And so I can only speculate that to have them lying prone, first of all, you know, you wouldn't be able to represent them and show them in all their, show all the parts.
Yes.
As if they were standing, for example, put or held into a standing position.
Yes. Because I suppose what they're drawing there is they're drawing death, aren't they? And it wasn't necessarily clear what happened when people passed away. What happened to the body? What happened to the spirit then? I don't know. Maybe we're going off track slightly, but it's a very interesting way in which these bodies, once they were drawn, were presented. They weren't necessarily presented in a way that we would consider a teaching sense nowadays.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think, I was speaking to the man, Machados, Carlos Machados, who does all the illustrations for Netta.
Ah, yes.
Sorry, for Netta's anatomy
book. Yes, they're fantastic images.
He came to give a talk at the University of Cape Town, and I was chatting with him, and he was saying that, yes, when he does his drawings, he needs to consider that the cadaver is actually lying down and that the organs are not like that when a person is standing up. So he has to take all of those things into consideration when he does his illustration. So yeah, I mean, I think there's a value to having the cadaver standing or seated. But, you know, that's for anatomy lecturers to decide.
Yeah, to populate their PowerPoint slides with, yes.
Yeah, I mean, one does turn them around, one does turn them over, and I think, you know, there's all kinds of issues with fluids and that need to drain.
Of course. Okay, so I suppose the kind of, just to finish on that kind of more abstract interpretation of the human form that some may engage with, and the kind of more recent images that are produced for kind of textbook learning. You visited the Tate Gallery in Britain, kind of out of interest for, I think, one of your favourite artists. I think you mentioned earlier on.
Yes.
Is it Frank Auber? Is that the connect pronunciation?
That's correct. Yes. So yeah.
tell us a little bit about his work, and that's very much a kind of interpretation of the human form, how he draws.
Yes. Well, Frank Auber, he is considered as one of Britain's most celebrated artists. He's, I think, 84 now. He came to Britain at a very young age, at the age of 8, from Germany. He's completely English. And he draws every single day and paints the portrait, the human head. He also does cityscapes, but I'm interested in his heads. And so he has people who sit for him every single day. The same person even has been sitting for 20 years
or
longer. Every week on the same day for 2 hours. And in any case, he had an exhibition. They gave him a retrospective exhibition in 7 rooms of the Tate, and this was something that I absolutely could not miss. Yes.
Sorry, Leonard, what's a retrospective exhibition? Sorry, that's my ignorance.
Sure, no, a retrospective exhibition is an exhibition which traces the history of his work from the 60s all the way till today. So they'll have pictures, paintings he made in 1960, 70s, 80s, until today.
So kind of depicting his life's work.
Yes, and you see how his style has developed, how his painting method has developed. So I went there to study from the master, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
So I took with me in my luggage a drawing board, piece of flat board, clips and paper and graphite, And I went to the Tate, and for 12 days, I, you know, arrived there at 10 in the morning and drew until tea time and lunchtime and had a break and just kept drawing and drew, looked at his marks that he makes when he describes a head. And then I drew. So when I looked at his marks, his drawing marks, his painting marks, it would be equivalent to a pianist looking at Mozart's notes on that he made for a piano and playing those notes. So I looked at his marks and played his marks in gesture, in drawing, on paper. It was the most amazing experience. I learned a huge amount. I mean, traditionally and typically, this is what artists do. They learn from the masters, but you can't go and look at a book because there's so much you can't see. So, that's what I did.
And what were other people there as well? Wow. Leonard's holding up a picture.
That's Frank Auerbach's. This is Auerbach's drawing.
Okay. So you've used graphite on a piece of paper to kind of to sketch out your interpretation of Auerbach's work.
That's right, of Auerbach's work. Yes. That's what I did. Yeah. And
so could you scan that, Leonard, and send it to me, and I can maybe put it on the website so people could have a look.
I will scan this and I'll send you my drawing as well of that drawing of his.
Fantastic. Yeah. Yes. And I'll put that, testing my technological abilities now. I'm not sure if I can put it in the show notes, but I will put it on the webpage that has your podcast. So if people are interested, then they can go to anatomypodcast.co.uk and find your podcast, and I'll put the pictures up there. So thank you very much for that. Sorry, and I interrupted you.
Yes, no, so that's what I did. And it was a fantastic learning experience. And that was the sole reason I went to London for those. Yeah.
And again, this is just my ignorance of kind of this area. Is that common? Do people go to art galleries to kind of draw other famous artists' work? That is a thing?
Yeah, it is a thing. In fact, when I was there, a number of people were drawing there, perhaps just for the day.
Yes.
And then schools came and drew. In fact, it's encouraged. One is not allowed to take photographs.
No.
But drawings are absolutely encouraged and done. It's a way of studying. I think it would be comparable to somebody watching a really good surgeon doing his or her work.
Yes.
And learning from that. It's being there and it's seeing how it's done.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm.
Okay.
I can look at his drawings and I can see how he formed the head through looking at the lines, looking at the marks that he made on the paper.
Yes.
Yeah. And the marks again just reflect what he was observing. This is the thing. Yeah.
Okay, Leonard, that's fantastic, and it'd be great if you can send over those pictures, and yes, I'll put them on the website so people can have a look and actually see what we've been talking about. So I think we should just maybe move on, actually, because obviously you've shared your passion, your interest, and why this is a real passion for you. But you also run numerous workshops, and you have this kind of special approach to this sort of work, the haptico-visual observation and drawing approach.
Yeah.
Now, I'll ask the question that maybe other people are thinking out there. What does that mean? What is the haptico-visual observation and drawing approach? What is it?
It's it's actually quite simple. But sometimes things that are simple are under our nose.
Yes, of course.
So it's a multisensory observation method. So we normally simply use our eyes to look and observe with. But the hand and touch is a really important sense. We gather a lot of data through touch. a lot of observational data. And the hand actually takes up a huge part of the sensory and motor cortex of the brain.
Yes.
A massive part, if you're familiar with the homunculus.
Yes, I'd hope the audience is familiar with the sensory homunculus on the post-central right. gyrus, yes.
So it's that little figure
yeah.
of a person, and it shows the relative amount of nerves from any part of the body that goes to the sensory cortex. And so the hand takes a lot of that, and you have a very different sense. I mean, if people are listening to this and they simply pick something up and feel it, look at it, and then feel it, you'll notice that you observe a lot more, and you observe differently. So what we do is we look at a bone or a wet specimen, and we touch it, and we make marks that reflect what we're feeling, what we're observing of that part. So that's what. So it's really just using touch and sight, combining them, using them as observational tools.
Yes. And I think we know this already, don't we? Whether we're kind of fully clear about it, but we use this in everyday life. And I use an example of it when I teach kind of spinothalamic and dorsocolumn and long pathways that run through the spinal cord. And I ask my students to put their hand in their pocket, and if they have some loose change in their pocket, then without seeing which coin it is, just by feeling the size and the shape and the texture of that coin, without seeing it, they can pull out a 1 penny, a 2p, a 50 pence, a £2 coin. How powerful that touch sensation is. And you can do it for everything. You can do it, you know, I can show you my office keys that are different, you know, the square one as opposed to the round one, you know, and it's incredibly powerful how you can differentiate that. And I suppose people who are blind use that skill all the time.
Yes. In fact, only yesterday I opened a gate with a key, and it was dark. And because I normally use sight to open this door, I had to use my sense of touch to determine which key it was, and it worked. But I wanted to get to, that's what I was going to say. I just wanted to say that Professors Roberta Klatsky and Susan Lederman have done research into haptics, which is touch.
Yes.
From the 68 until, I think, 2012. So extensive research into haptics. And, of course, they identify a number of what they call exploratory procedures, which, as you say, we do all the time, like lateral stroking or grasping.
Yes.
And these give us different types of data about an object, about the nature of an object.
Yes, and a lot of kind of this work is being done in the education sphere as well, because we have this growing kind of virtual reality aspect to education, and actually we have haptics as well. So you can have these virtual reality surgical simulations where you're not just seeing in 3D space the arrangement of arteries and veins and various structures, but actually when you put in your equipment, you can actually feel resistance within the haptics. If you're doing some drilling for removing teeth or something, you can actually feel the resistance of the drill, all in a virtual reality space using this haptic technology. So I can clearly see and appreciate how it can have an impact on drawing. You do these workshops where you support people to develop this skill. It's something to do with lateral leap. Is this a series of workshops that you've developed and can go around and support people who are interested?
Yes, lateral leap is a name I gave before I started doing this work on a university level. Lateral leap is a name that I gave to form a sort of a brand identity, So I do a lot of work through the University of Cape Town's continuing education unit. I present a course for medical professionals as well as students. And for the medical professionals, they get CPD, continuing professional development points.
Yes.
And it's certificated.
Yes.
And I teach them a deeper observation through this method.
So what will happen in a workshop? If we're relying on touch to to create these drawings,
right.
What do you do? Do you blindfold the participants and get them to draw whilst feeling? I don't know. I just if it's all about touch.
Yes, there are times where I ask them to close their eyes and feel something, and then open the eyes so they're touching and feeling. So it's combining those senses. But what we do first actually is because we make, you know, gestures all the time. Look, observation using touch is about gesture. When we feel something, we are moving our upper limb and digits to feel something, to observe something. And then with our drawing hand, with our other hand, we are making sort of concomitant gestures. We're making gestures that equate or equivalent to what we're feeling. It's really it's that simple. But what people do normally is they say they can't draw. What I interpret that as is I can't make gestures. So what people do normally is they in our daily life we make movements that are repetitive, you know, that are in keeping with our urban environment. Well, you know, we do up our buttons, we stir the coffee, we make these repeated gestures, we switch on the car, we climb up some stairs. So what we need to do in order to implement this method is we need to get the participants, the workshop participants, to make gestures that are non-repetitive, that are sort of spontaneous, and so that when they are feeling the undulations of a bone or a wet specimen, and they're feeling maybe the spaces inside the wet specimen with their feeling hand, as I'll call it, then with the other hand, they're tracing out, they're almost sculpting on paper the form. You know, this is really all about understanding the three-dimensional form of an anatomical part, and or the space, the three-dimensional space inside, say, for example, the human heart. And the marks, people might think, well, why draw it? You see, the marks that we make with our hand when we're observing something with our other hand, the marks that we make have a value.
Yes.
We can see, we can look at those marks, and those marks are like letters. They're like a language. They will say, yes, that mark is an accurate reflection of that aspect of the anatomical part. In the same way that, like Auerbach's marks, they might look all messy, you know, but they are accurate, value-laden marks that reflect the human head, in his case, with the workshop participants, reflect the three-dimensional nature of the anatomical part. Now, at the same time, when the workshop participant looks at their drawing, they can tell quite easily which aspects they have not observed so well.
Okay.
And then they can go back and repalpate that aspect, that anatomical part, and continue to draw it again. Mm. Yeah.
So start off, you kind of get them to try and be one with what they're touching and how that transfers from kind of their left hand into their right hand that they're making these gestures. So to get both limbs working in concert together.
Yes.
When do you then sort of like introduce, I don't know, a humerus or a skull? Because, you know, a humerus and the head of the humerus, the head of the femur, although it can look pretty simple, He's got a couple of trochanters, a couple of bulges on. He's got the large round head. Actually, touching it brings in a lot more detail, doesn't it, than what it just looks like. So is there a bit of a transition period? Do you get to draw, you know, something simple like a pencil just by feeling that before you go on to more complex structures?
I first get them to draw a hammer. It's a 200-gram ball peen hammer. I have a box full of them. And everyone draws that because it's, you know, if you get someone to draw anatomical part straight away, there's this intimidation. They feel intimidated, like, oh, I've got to draw it like Michelangelo or Leonardo da Vinci. I've got to draw that type of drawing, but it's not about that at all. So I get them to draw a hammer, to feel it, touch it, palpate, you know, feel it and look at it, and then draw it. But before that, you know, as I said to you, I get them to scribble on paper and then look at the kind of scribbles they do. And normally people do these very, very repetitive scribbles. But I then get them to make, through a series of exercises, to make more sort of less repetitive, more conscious. That's the point. Conscious gestures, conscious scribbles, so that when they're feeling with their one hand, they can make conscious scribbles with their other hand, not scribbles, sorry, conscious gestures with their other hand, which have value. The marks have a value. They say something about what they're feeling. Whereas when you scribble and just make repetitive marks, first of all, a repetitive mark will just reflect the architecture of the upper limb. So you'll make these kind of curves, these sort of curves on paper. But when you're making gestures, conscious gestures, you're able to almost think about, quote unquote, think through what you are touching and reflect it on paper. And I tell you the reports from people are that they indeed see more. And even though a student has studied, or even a medical professional has studied the humerus and knows it from its annotated version or from surgery or from prosections, they still report seeing things they hadn't seen before. Let me qualify that. Not seeing things they haven't seen before, but observing things they haven't seen before.
And ultimately the end goal is for them to draw a complex anatomical structure, maybe like a wet specimen, like a heart. And could you go into the detail of drawing the papillary muscles and the chordae tendineae within the chambers of a ventricle?
Yes, well...
Chambers of a heart in the ventricle, sorry?
Yes. Well, first it's to understand the spaces, the empty spaces. So whereas with a humerus or any other bone, we are drawing the three-dimensional form. We're drawing this solid, as it were, solid structure. Whereas with the human heart, we're drawing the empty spaces. So we're actually drawing the empty spaces. I mean, I had this challenge. I was going to be teaching some students to observe the heart as a wet specimen. And I thought, well, I need to look at it first. I need to study it first. And I'd never understood the heart. I'd never studied it from an anatomy textbook. And so I just took this wet specimen and I started feeling it and putting my fingers in it. Of course, it was dissected. Yes. And I realized, the way to understand this is to draw the empty spaces. And so now when I close my eyes, I can see, I can go in to the atrium and then down through the valves into the ventricles, and then up through the up into the lower aorta, etc., etc. I've got that in my mind now, because a byproduct of observation in this method is memorization. So you actually can literally see in your mind's eye a visual image of what you have been observing. That's another benefit of this, and that stays.
Yeah.
You know, so yes, you know, you draw these empty spaces, and indeed, yes, you can put in these all the detail as well within those spaces.
So,
yeah.
So how have you, or if you have, and I know you've done some work, as we spoke about it earlier in the podcast. How has this moved into maybe anatomy education in a more formal setting? How have these skills actually been developed within an anatomy course? Do you have any experience of students engaging in this way and the sort of the impact of it, perhaps?
Oh yes, absolutely. For about 4 years now, I've been taking a group of anatomy students on a 10-day workshop, a 10-day course, which, you know, they've got to pass, etc. But and so they've gone through this process of learning this method. And indeed, myself and one of the professors, actually two of the profs at University of Cape Town, we did a study, a qualitative study on the students' experience of this. And so we did, they were recorded. They were asked questions, and these questions were recorded and transcribed. Yes. And indeed what came out was that they perceived more, they were able to memorize as a visual image and draw, and then draw that visual image of whatever they'd been looking at, that's the humerus or the human skull, they were able to then draw that again later on. And also what's interesting is they actually can annotate their drawings. They can take their drawing of a humerus and then take an atlas and look at the atlas and compare it to their drawing and annotate their drawing.
Oh, wow.
Now, if they cannot find the a part that has been annotated in the atlas, because obviously the parts in the atlas are annotated for good reason, they're showing the sort of important aspects of the osteology that need to be learned, and right? So if they can't find that in their drawing, they know they need to go and observe more.
Yes.
Draw again, and then annotate again. So it's a nice, it's a good learning process, and that's a great complementary process to the anatomy atlas. So.
Yeah.
Again, it augments the atlas.
Yes, yes. Mm. Okay, Leonard. So what's next? What other little things have you got going on in regard to this kind of approach to kind of art and anatomy? What have you got on the horizon?
Well, I must say, I met a few years ago. I met up with Dr. Ian Keenan from
yes.
Newcastle University.
Yes.
And he's also using art and artistic approaches in anatomy education. And we're now collaborating on, we're writing a descriptive paper together on this method. He has a method called ORDER, O-R-D-E-R, which stands for observe, reflect, draw, edit, repeat. I think people can look it up.
Yeah, I think I heard the talk at an AMI conference a few years ago, yes.
Yes. And so what we're doing is putting the best together of both of our observation methods, and we are going to make a MOOC, which is, people know what a MOOC is?
A massive open online course.
That's it, yeah.
Yes.
So we're making one of those. It will be a video MOOC. Obviously, to teach anatomy students and to help them with observation. So this MOOC will be with FutureLearn.
Yeah.
And in addition to that, Ian invited me last year in 2017 in May to Newcastle University to run a observation workshop for anatomists who he invited from the UK, which was really fantastic. I mean, people loved it and benefited from it. And then we also doing myself, Ian Keenan, Ian Johnson in Adelaide University, and the PhD student whose name is Toby. Sorry that I forget his surname. His surname is Toby Branson. So we are going to be doing an experiment with about 500 students. This would be an empirical experiment using electroencephalogram to measure brain activity while using an observation method that will include touch.
That sounds really, really interesting. That sounds really interesting, and to see how that touch maps onto the cortex. I suppose to see if it does follow the traditional path that we teach our students in neuroanatomy classes, to see if that actually maps in any way, or if there's anything else going on. So that'll be really interesting.
Can I just cover something that I didn't cover?
Yeah, go for it.
And it's that I just want to emphasize that. I mean, I came from an art background, and then I really took a step into the science world. And this is where I feel fantastically comfortable, is in the science world with scientists working scientifically. So this drawing method, it's not a drawing method, I keep saying it, it's an observation method primarily. We are looking at it scientifically, and how it can benefit medical students and medical professionals to make them into better observers, and therefore, you know, better medical practitioners.
Yes.
You know? So this is the value of it.
Yes. So it really does, because it really does bring in some additional elements to a medical student's training, which is beyond just learning gross anatomical facts. And there is much more of a drive to introduce more humanities and art-based subjects into a medical curriculum, to give students that, to broaden the horizon, to appreciate other elements and how different tools can support them in developing these kind of more rounded skills that I suppose we want our medical students to be as they go into the workplace.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the briefs that I had from the one professor was to give students a more holistic approach, and to what he said was to rehumanize the human body. And so, quite literally, I thought to myself, one could take a live human being, a living human being, and put them on the cadaver table. But of course, you know, instead of doing that, I simply, because one can't just do that, it could be a bit weird, you know. But so then in the workshop, I got a living human being to sit as a nude model. So the students will, and with a skeleton next to him. So the students, this was near the end of the course when they'd really got to grips with observation. And so they then drew his body, and I actually pointed with my laser pointer to the clavicle on the skeleton, and I said, "You see that?" And then I pointed onto this person, this breathing human being, and I said, "That's in him." Mm. And it was quite an awakening for them, because of course they know that's in him. But if you can understand that, they see that, but they see that skeleton as sort of a skeleton that they learn him from. And the human being, they don't see that is in him. But it was like, oh, wow, yeah, that's true.
Yes.
You know, that's in him.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that's probably a good place to kind of wrap up the podcast, actually. That kind of... The aim of this is to perhaps look at the human more holistically, and to look at the human as a whole rather than siloed little compartments, be that the skeletal system, the respiratory system, the cardiovascular system. But together, all of those systems create the human beings that we all are. And and developing that kind of view of the human, I certainly think is a wonderful thing, and thing that we should perhaps be supporting our students to be more aware of.
Yes, absolutely, yes.
Excellent. Okay, Leonard, thank you ever so much for coming on the podcast. I'll let you go and return back to sunny South Africa and whatever the afternoon holds for you in Cape Town. So thank you very much for coming on the podcast. And we have talked about many things, talked about your introduction to this kind of observational approach, as you say, not a drawing approach, and talked about the workshops and various other things. One thing, Leonard, you're on Twitter, aren't you? But I didn't actually ask you beforehand what your Twitter handle is. So if people do want to follow you on Twitter, what should they do?
It's Leonard_Shapiro.
Perfect. Perfect. So what I will do is, as ever, I will put the various links to Leonard's Twitter account and various bits and bobs that we've discussed. And if Leonard can kindly provide us with that scan of a picture, I'll put that onto the website. So, Leonard, thank you very much for coming on the podcast. If you'd like to continue the conversation and talk about anything that we've discussed, then you can use the hashtag #AndThatPodcast. So, Leonard, thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, James. It's been great.
No worries at all. No worries at all. And until next time, cheerio.